It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. The German car maker Audi announced last month that they would stop making manual transmission cars in the U.S. According to London's IHS Market, stick shifts represented nearly 7% of U.S. vehicle sales in 2012. This year, it estimates manuals will make up 3.5% of sales. For some, the stick shift has this romantic image, even if they would never actually drive one again. One wonders why we would hold on to something that made life more inconvenient. Brian Cooley explored Americans' relationships with manual transmissions in a piece he wrote for CNET entitled Why Americans Hate Manual Transmissions. Cooley is an editor at large for CNET. Brian, welcome to the program.
Hi, Carrie. Good morning.
Good morning. So your actual piece is entitled Why Americans Hate Manual Transmissions. And then you say in the piece that hate may be too strong a word. Is this too strong a word?
The more I think about it, it's not. As you mentioned, some car makers are giving up on manuals entirely. The market share, in the 3% range, it's going to dwindle down to about 1% by 2025. That's pretty much close to turning our back on this technology.
So what are the benefits of driving a vehicle with a manual transmission? Why do people like them?
As you mentioned, there's a certain romance to it, to be honest. There's a certain capability. It's part of the past. It's part of a heritage. It also puts you more in touch with the vehicle and gives you a more connected driving experience. Mm-hmm. It also gives you the ability to, in some cases, get out of a rut or being stuck in snow if you know how to do that. But increasingly, a lot of people don't, because maybe they don't even know anyone who drove a manual. So it's a bit of an institutional knowledge that's being lost over time, and that's also gutting some of the appeal of the manual.
So as automatic cars get easier to drive, do you hear people lamenting that our driving is getting worse because of it?
There's that idea. I don't know that we can connect that to data. It's very difficult because you have to tease out all the safety innovations from cars to say, are we having a more dangerous experience on the road because we're less attentive or not? Because we're walking away from accidents that used to kill everybody 30 years ago, but that's because of the amazing innovations in crash survival and crash prevention. So it's hard to tease it out and say, are we becoming more laid-back, lazy, dangerous drivers? But I do know that people are embracing the automatic or variants of it. There are several varieties because we're a convenience-oriented culture for the most part, and that isn't the case in every other country that is high in motoring, but that is how we approach motoring for the most part.
And this doesn't even get into the idea that automatic transmissions may be a wave of the past when we have self-driving cars.
Yeah, exactly. Self-driving cars are another area where there may be an automatic transmission or some kind of transmission, but we won't know or care.
Right, it'll be an automatic driver too. Yes.
Right. David. And the other thing about this is there also are going to be a lot of electric or electrified cars that do have a transmission technically, but it's so simple you'd barely recognize one as a driver, and many of our listeners own one right now in their plug-in hybrid or EV.
That is true. We've got a couple of calls coming in. David from Drummond, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you.
Yes.
I just think everybody needs to get back to driving a manual. There's absolutely nothing like it. My last five vehicles, and in fact, all the vehicles prior to that, my dad had driven. And, growing up on a farm, you learn a clutch on a tractor.
Right, right.
It's something that's You just can't replace with an automatic. I mean, yeah, we're letting people get in, give them the keys, they toss it in the ignition, they put it in drive and go. Where's the fun? Where's the enjoyment?
I hear you, David. I do love driving a manual transmission, but I've also been stuck in traffic, Brian, with a manual transmission. We are a unique in this country that only about 3% of people drive a manual. In other parts of the world, they're still popular. Why is that? Brian, we seem to have lost Brian. So we are taking your calls about automatic and manual transmissions. 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org while we try to get Brian back. We're talking about the fact that only 3% of cars that are sold in this country are stick shifts, are manual transmissions, and Audi, for one, has decided to stop selling them in this country. But about 45% of cars worldwide are stick shifts. Kelly from Burlington, welcome to the program.
Hi. I have driven a stick shift my entire life since I learned how to drive, and have never owned a manual transmission, and would hope to never own a manual or ever own an automatic. They're far more fun to drive.
Mm-hmm.
They get better gas mileage. You have far better control, I think. And it, expert said, it makes you pay attention. It makes you stay awake and pay attention to your driving. When I drive an automatic, it's like sitting on a couch, and you don't have to hardly any pay attention at all. It makes you way too lazy.
Yeah, I hear you. Brian Cooley, we have you back here. I want you to answer this lazy question and also talk about why the rest of the world loves manual transmissions and we don't.
A lot of it has to do with cost historically. Let's look at the auto market in Brazil. It's one that I called out in my piece. It's a huge automotive market. It's a large, developed country, and they're looking at a cost of about $1,000 or so to buy a new car there with an automatic, just like us. But there's a country where the average household income is a fraction of ours, so they look at that additional cost of an automatic, and this applies in many countries. This is going on in India, for example, many of these countries that are motorizing, and it's a deal breaker to purchase a car with an automatic on a financial front. Yeah. So that's always been historical. And as the last caller mentioned, there's always been this idea that the automatic, which has been derisively called the slush box for decades, soaks up power, disengages you from driving, and results in a slower, more slovenly performing car. Two of the three are not correct anymore. Automatic transmissions are as fuel efficient, or sometimes more so, than manual transmissions, and generally they give you a faster, better performing car. It is not really correct anymore to say that an automatic is this sloppy, fuel-wasting thing. That was true in the 70s, the 80s, but starting in the 90s, the automatic started to become the more fuel-efficient, higher-performance choice. That's why companies like Ferrari don't even offer them anymore.
Earlier this year, though, Honda launched a campaign to teach people how to drive cars with manual transmissions. So why did they go that route?
I don't know. Bless their heart. Sometimes you will find that a car maker's marketing company is saying, look, here's a way to stand out and be different, appeal to a certain niche market. That may get us a bunch of buzz on Instagram or something. There is no logical explanation for a car maker. And they occasionally will do this, will show you the joy of how they still offer a manual, but then go look at their mix, and they're not spending any investment on manual transmissions. They're not making them any better to drive. A couple companies do have manual transmissions that will automatically match RPMs, so that difficult task for some people of matching RPMs to get the clutch to engage smoothly is handled by a computer. But now you're halfway to an automatic transmission again.
Mm-hmm. So as societies advance, so one of the reasons you gave for why manuals are popular in other parts of the world is cost. As societies advance, as people make more money, do you think that we're going to see manual transmissions go away completely?
Yeah, and a lot of it's going to have to do with regulation, interestingly enough. We're talking about this as being strictly a matter of choice, but the automatic transmission is starting to become a matter of regulation, and that's because if you want to achieve very tight and lofty targets for MPG being high and CO2 emissions being low, the latter of which is a very big deal in Europe, you need to control the car with a computer. You can't leave it to the whims of a driver, some of whom might be heavy-footed, some of whom might drive the drivetrain very differently. A manual lets you do that, but that doesn't work in the future. If we want to dial in these final remaining little amounts of CO2 and MPG adjustment, you have to put that in the hands of a computer, and that can only be done with an automatic. A manual transmission is not a digitally addressable device by the car's computers. And that's the big picture here of why car makers are not trying to bring the manual back and not trying to encourage us to love it. Plus, if you want to use advanced driver assist features.
Brian, I'm going to have to cut you there. Brian Cooley is an editor at large for CNET, and he wrote the recent piece, Why Americans Hate Manual Transmissions. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Teens used to dream of college, the clubs they would join, the friends they would make, the independence they would have. They still dream of this, but on the edge of that dream is kind of a hint of a nightmare. How do I pay for this? There are definitely ways to pay for college that don't involve student loans. You have to work a little to figure them out. And Clifford Robb is going to talk us through our options. He is an associate professor of consumer science and faculty director of consumer finance and financial planning at UW-Madison. He is sitting in studio with us now. Welcome to the program, Cliff.
Oh, thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
So when it comes to paying for college, how important is it that parents and students have a plan in place?
Oh, I mean, I think it's really critical given the way we've seen college costs continue to increase over the past several decades. And so when you look at planning for college and thinking about college, it's always important to start as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. So ideally, you think about, okay, I'm going to have children. Part of that plan would be like, what's their future going to look like? Maybe I might start putting away a little bit as soon as possible. That doesn't always happen, but that doesn't mean you should feel discouraged and not try. So I always encourage people to kind of take wherever they are in life, take some proactive steps to kind of think about it and kind of prepare for your children.
There are long-term planning, which you just started to talk about. There are also short-term. I want to look at some more long-term. There are things like 529 plans. There are things like EdVest. Are those things that new parents, when they bring their kids home from the hospital, should be calling their financial planner about?
I think it's a really good starting point, yes. So that's the kind of thing where you look at something like EdVest, which is Wisconsin's sponsored 529 plan. Mm-hmm. Every single state has their own version of this, so they have some sort of 529 plan. They do vary by state, but what's really nice about 529 plans is they're not state-specific, and they don't lock you in any way. So if you started investing in a Wisconsin 529 plan when your child was born here, but then you happen to relocate or move somewhere else, or your child wants to go somewhere else for college, there's no problems with that money essentially moving.
You don't have to go to a UW school.
No, you're not locked in. Now, in saying that, I will qualify that some 529 plans are prepaid tuition models. So you'd really want to make sure you're distinguishing between an education savings plan and a prepaid tuition model. Because if you're in the prepaid tuition model, you are kind of locking in because you're going ahead and paying an institution for credits ahead of time at current prices.
But the upside of a prepaid tuition model, as I understand it, is in the year 2000, the tuition for X school was, let's just guess, $10,000 a year. And now, in the year 2018, that tuition for that school was $20,000 a year, but you've prepaid at that $10,000 a year level. Is that correct?
That is correct. So that's the idea, is you're pre-purchasing credits at current dollars. And the one thing I would say is I do think it's a good plan for many people. But just be sure that you feel secure about that institution financially, because there is evidence in some cases of credits might not be fully honored. And if you run into the problem, if your child does not want to attend that institution, you're kind of like, well, this is all we got. Right?
You've kind of locked it in. Yeah.
Yeah, this is where we've invested our dollars.
Do you have a college plan in place? Do you have a 529 for your child? Or do you know what that is? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. We are talking right now to financial planning professor Cliff Robb about how to pay for college. So when we are selecting a plan, and there's EdVest, which is Wisconsin's 529 plan, and 529 plans are tax-free. How does that work in terms of taxes?
They are tax-advantaged to encourage savings. So what happens is any dollars you put into a 529 plan will grow federal income tax-free, and any dollars withdrawn from those plans in the future to pay for qualified education expenses will be federal and state income tax-free. So there'll be no tax on the dollars in the future, which is the hope, right, that you put it in early, it grows and grows and grows, and you withdraw it with no tax implications.
So when this was first when they first came up with this plan, this was for college. Those qualified expenditures were college. Nowadays, though, thanks, I think, to the tax reform from last year, you can use it for other things
college. Yeah, it's a little bit more flexible, right? So you can also technically apply a certain amount of dollars towards private tuition for education at the K through 12 level.
Mm-hmm.
So you can use some of those dollars can be used for education pre-college. You can also use it for, think about it as not strictly tuition, right? Qualified expenses is pretty broad, including things like room and board, potentially like computers and other technology that might be necessary for learning, textbooks, supplies. It's a pretty broad definition to say, like, these are qualified education. It's not just saying I paid tuition directly with these dollars.
We are talking with Cliff Robb about how to pay for college and how to start a plan. If you are panicking out there, if you have maybe a 13-year-old and you haven't put anything away, give us a call and talk to us about it, and we can maybe help you kind of figure out where to go from here. 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. So let's say I'm a student who's in high school, and I haven't saved anything for college, and my parents haven't saved anything for college, and yet I want to go to college. So where should I start?
Well, that's a situation where a lot of people find themselves. So, again, it's not something I would necessarily panic about. But I think it's a situation where you'd want to be – you need to be proactive again. And this is a case where the student and the parents can really be aggressive in trying to seek out what are the financial opportunities available that help assist with college expenses. So depending on situation, income level, there might be resources available from that institution specifically or more broadly for – education planning. So I would really be aggressive at blanketing scholarships, grants, all those opportunities for money that's essentially not something I'm going to have to pay back.
So I've heard of friends who have gotten a scholarship from their local American Legion or some sort of local chapter of this. And I think, wow, I didn't realize those places gave out. It's only $1,000 or $2,000, but it's a class. And so is there like a database that we could go to that has the list of every scholarship in this country?
I am not sure about that, actually. That's a good question. If there is one, that'd be a great resource. So if anyone knows about that, I'd love to hear about it.
If anyone wants to start that, would be fine,
too.
That
would be a helpful thing, right?
So talk to me about scholarships versus grant money.
Yeah, so when we think about a lot of education planning or a lot of the resources provided for education currently come in the form of kind of like scholarship or federal aid, right? Or, you know, it's loan based. So that's where you typically have to be more careful, is because as you're thinking about paying for education, it is money that will have to be paid back. And students have to be really mindful, I think, of trying to make decisions about future potential income paths and reasonable expenses that can be covered by these loans. Because I think it's something for them, for maybe a loan or financial aid officer to tell you, here's what you're qualified for. But then I think you really need to do your own homework determining, well, how much do I really need? You don't necessarily want to be like, okay, this is how much I can have, so take all of it. I think there's a lot on the individual making the decision about their college spending of how much they should be taking on in debt.
When you say that, I'm like, let's go backwards here, because I think there are a lot of people, parents as well as teenagers, who don't really understand how finances work in that kind of way. There are a lot of people here in Madison who work for the university, and they get it. But I don't know that my parents did necessarily when I was going into college. I certainly had no understanding of finances and what happened with these loans. So are there classes that we could take to get the information we need to know in high school before we start making these decisions?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think it's dependent on where you're going to school and what options are available.
You teach these classes at UW.
We teach them at college,
obviously.
But that's sometimes too late, right? If you get into my class as a junior and it's like, well, I wish I'd known that 2 years ago, right?
And people say that to you, I assume.
We get a lot of that, unfortunately. We have introduced, like within our financial planning curriculum and personal finance curriculum, we offer lower level courses in this that are geared towards freshmen and sophomores. So hopefully get some more of those in. But I do think the high school level is a great place to start. There are good websites out there. Like one I found was collegesavings.org. Mm-hmm. That's just one word, college savings. It has a lot of good information on 529 plans and costs of college and planning calculators. Those are really nice things that anyone could go to. It's a very accessible website, nice basic information. But so, yeah, as you know, not guaranteeing that a school is going to do it for you. I do right. think it gets put a little bit on the individual.
It's really hard to talk to a student going into college and kind of facing this whole new world about ROI, return on investment.
Yeah.
But that's kind of what you're talking about when you're saying, how much do I want to spend on college and how much am I going to make afterwards? If I really, really want to be a teacher, then I need to think about how much I'm going to put out, rather than if I want to be a doctor or if I want to be a lawyer, I'm going to spend a lot more, but I'm also going to make a lot more.
Yeah, it's very much an investment in yourself. It's a human capital investment.
Because I want to talk when we get back about how to calculate that when you are 16, 17 years old. We are talking to Cliff Robb about going to college and how to pay for college and how to plan for that. And plan for the rest of your life when your life is just getting started. We're taking your calls here, 800-642-1234. You can tell us about your college plan. It is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Not that long ago, high school students didn't start thinking about college till their senior year. Some go-getters started their exploration as juniors, but that was pretty much the exception. Now it feels like we need to have college planning courses for middle schoolers or maybe even preschoolers, and certainly their parents. We're talking about how to pay for and make a plan for college this morning with Cliff Robb, who teaches financial planning at UW-Madison. Are you confident in the plan that you've drawn up for your children's college? Are you just hoping it will be robust enough to not put them in crippling debt after they earn their degree? Do you have a plan for your kids' college? 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org is the email address, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. Cliff, we left off talking about how to learn about financial planning, and we've got a caller here, Owen. Welcome to the program, Owen.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, when I was, I'm almost 40, I'll be 40 this year. When I was 17, I graduated high school, and I was eligible to get full student loans because I was a ward of the state. So I did get a little bit of grant money, but most of it was all borrowed money from the federal programs. And there was a loan officer that came and helped me sign papers. She made it extremely easy for me to borrow all this money.
Mm.
Yes.
Never sat down and talked to me about finance or how I was going to pay it back or what my annual income was going to be and how much of that I had to allocate towards paying the loans off in a timely manner where I would be eligible to buy a home in the future or protect my credit and all these things that you need as an adult to gain equity and further your financial stability throughout your life. So now I'm faced with this agony of knowing that my student debt ratio is so high and I'm unable to pay because I make a lower wage than most people that are professionals do. And even if you go to emergency rooms and talk to the doctors in the emergency rooms, they'll tell you that the amount of money they have to borrow doesn't really equalize the amount of expenses that they have throughout their careers, you know, as far as their insurance rates and things like that. They're paying a lot of money out initially to go to school and end up probably being in a lot of debt their whole lives because of that. So it doesn't really matter what your career choice is and how much money you're going to make. It matters how much you're going to be able to pay back. So I think as part of the student entrance college exam program, like SATs, PSATs, we need to show a command of understanding finance and credit and how that affects our day-to-day decisions that we make throughout our life and how we can become productive members of the society.
Oh, and that is a great idea. Thank you for calling with that. I appreciate your story. What do you say to that there, Cliff?
Oh, I think that's, a fantastic idea. So when you look at it, what we really would love to see, those of us who are financial educators and financial counselors, the idea is that we want this to start early. It has to be in the households. It has to be in the schools. And I do think, barring it not becoming a normal thing in, like, say, middle school to high school, households do take a big piece of this, right? They have to engage their children and talk to them about the fact that, you know, the reality is things cost money. The reality is education is going to cost money. And understanding what reasonable costs are and determining what manageable goals are, that's a challenge for all of us.
And teaching it through school, I also feel I've heard this thing kind of thing before, you know, just sign here. Just sign here and we'll give you all these loans and you can go to college. And nobody, it's not the banker's job to explain to you what that means for the future. But a kid, especially a kid like Owen, who was awarded the state, doesn't necessarily have anybody else to teach him.
Yeah, and the sad technicality is that the information and the answers are there, but they're somewhere in that document you signed, right? And so how many of us peruse in detail these contracts that are multiple pages with very small print and very technical, mm-hmm. so that you would have to spend a lot of time deciphering and reading the language. And so I do think it's unfortunate at times that sometimes the model is not as straightforward as it should be, and it's not as consumer-centric as it should be, right? So we should be thinking a lot more about the individual and the decision they're making rather than let's just get the paperwork processed and move to the next, right?
We are talking about paying for college, and we're taking your calls. Marcus from Milwaukee, welcome to the program, Marcus.
Hi. So I have a comment about what was just said, and then I also have a question. Mm-hmm. I was raised that you should never sign something if you haven't read the whole thing and fully understand it. That being said, my situation is this. I'm a father of four children. My oldest son is going to be 16 this coming January, and then my daughter right behind him will be 13 this coming May. I'm still paying off the student loans from when I went to UW-Milwaukee. I have a double major in political science and history with a minor in psychology, and then I have 24 or 42 credits done towards a master's of public administration. Unfortunately, I do nothing with the degree I have. I actually do remodeling and construction, carpentry, whatever. So I guess my question is how or what would be the best way to try and help get my kids set up so that I could save some money for them while still managing a mortgage, business insurance, car payments, you know, so on and so forth, and then also paying down my own student loans. About $45,000 in outstanding student loans.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Marcus. Cliff?
Yeah, that's a very real challenge that a lot of us face. Mm-hmm. I would say one of the nice things about something like a 529 plan for the children in your scenario is that there are very low initial contribution limits. So even if it's not, you know, it's not like you have to have thousands today to start it. It's not like you even have to have hundreds to start it. So whatever amount you can get moving towards helping them, I think that would be beneficial. I think that would be wise. And also, you know, again, work with them on determining, I think using your own experience as a template is helpful to say, like, you know, this is what I did, but here's what I'm doing with that degree, and think really hard about what it is they want to do. I think lots of times college is taken as this have to and given model, whereas I think there should be a lot of thought going into that decision, and the child should be, or really the young adult should be, just as engaged in the process of determining what is the reason for it and what's going to be the benefits.
It also strikes me that Marcus started college in a world that looked much different, right? He started college in the go, late 90s, early 2000s. And where people were making lots of money, and then suddenly, just after he got out of college, there was a crash in the economy, and our wages have not risen like that. So he's kind of stuck in the middle. Is that a phenomenon where there are people kind of stuck in the middle with, I have debt, and my kids are growing up?
Yeah, I think that's real for a lot of people. Unfortunately, that there's people that, yeah, they borrowed a lot in the, as you noted, the mid to late 90s or the early 2000s, and that money is still being paid back, but now they're having families of their own, and they're dealing with things like mortgages and car payments and possibly business insurance, as noted, that there's all these factors. And so it makes it very difficult, and what you can see is that not going into these decisions with a very clear plan and not understanding all the myriad factors involved makes it really tough because it has these compounding effects, right? That it ends up determining and influencing a lot of later life choices.
Okay, so let's talk about student loans. I want to know if there's a magic number that I need to owe. What's the, he talked, somebody, I think it was Owen, who talked about debt ratio, income to debt ratio. So talk to me about that.
I think it's really tough to pin down saying like a magic number with regard to student loans because everyone's situation is going to be different. So it's hard for me to say you need to have this much. But I do think you want to be reasonable in looking at the fact that there are caps on, you know, federal student loans. Like you can only get so many dollars, in, especially in subsidized. So looking at those caps and being meaningful about, okay, do I really need more than that? And if you find yourself in a situation where those loans aren't enough, that's where I really start to ask questions because then you're having to delve into the private loan market. Mm. And the private loan market looks a whole lot different than the federal subsidized student loan market.
I want to go back to Marcus for a second, though.
Sure.
His teenage kids don't have any money put away for college, from what I gleaned from what he said. There are things like scholarships and contests that they could look at now that could start to help them pay. What are those things?
There's a whole lot of things. I'm not sure right off the top of my head. Like, there's so many opportunities out there.
How do we find them?
I would start with sometimes if you're looking at a certain university, I would start by communicating through looking at opportunities with that university in particular. That's usually a good way to start because contacting the financial aid office, seeing what opportunities there are. Sometimes there's, you can judge... there's needs-based assistance, though that might be based on income. There might be special scholarships for specific minority groups or groups that are in first-generation college students also.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all kinds of different opportunities out there. Another technique I would encourage in this kind of situation, a lot of people look at college as this very direct and simple model of this is what it costs to go to the four-year flagship institution. In a lot of situations, you might be better off identifying a local, lesser cost, maybe two-year institution to get your core credits done. And I know a lot of people do that, and it's a very, I think, wise technique, especially if you're worried about the overall cost of, say, a four-year plan to, like, UW-Madison.
Mm-hmm.
So looking at those local community colleges, being able to stay home potentially for the first 2 years and save some expenses there, having less cost with regard to the courses, and getting your core credits kind of knocked out, because honestly, some of those basic classes, they're viewed as being identical, right? So mm-hmm. you can transfer them right over to another institution with no penalty to you.
We are talking about the cost of college, how to save for college, what you should be looking for in terms of student loans, in terms of grants, scholarships. There are a lot of grants and scholarships out there that you have to kind of work to figure out. We're talking right now to Cliff Robb, who is a UW faculty member who teaches financial planning for college kids. But we were trying to figure out how to do that before you go to college. We are going to be back in a moment. We'll take your calls and talk more to Cliff. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're talking about getting yourself or your children through college without too much debt. But how much is too much? And once we have it, what's the best way to pay it off? Do we have options for reducing the debt if we, say, work as a teacher or get a job or can't get a job at all? What are your questions about paying for college? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. I'm sitting here with Cliff Robb, who is an associate professor of consumer science at UW-Madison. He teaches people about student debt. Rob, I want to know about the FAFSA. A lot of kids have heard about this. A lot of parents have heard about this. it seems like this overwhelming thing. You have to put like all your financial data in it. What's the FAFSA and why is it important?
Well, it's really the form that's required for in order to get, you know, student aid. You have to file a form that essentially shows your income levels and eligibility for aid. And so they use that as a formula to determine how much the school is willing to give you. So if you're looking for student aid in the form of grants from or loans from an institution, it's a form you'll have to file. It's not required that you file it if you don't need aid. So not every student necessarily has to do it. Mm-hmm. But I think in a lot of cases, students are encouraged to at least look at it, right? So at least that first year you get to college, a lot of people say, well, you should at least fill out the FAFSA just to see what might be available to you. So even if you feel pretty secure in your college financing plan, it doesn't hurt you to check, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I do encourage students to at least look at it. I think it's become a little bit less onerous over the years in terms of getting it filled out, but it's still something to do.
So the FAFSA means Free Application for Federal Student Aid, and FAFSA is the acronym. And what you're saying is if I fill it out, then it might lead me to various scholarship opportunities and those kinds of things?
It would basically suggest, it would give you a good clear picture of what kind of aid is available to you from the institution. So they'd be able to tell you, okay, this is how much we can give you, say, per semester or year. And so for some people, it's a nice information tool because
mm-hmm.
It may be that you only need a small amount of loans, but the FAFSA is going to basically tell you how much they're willing to give you. So that's why I always suggest doing your own kind of front-end estimates before you go in to kind of see what they have available.
And you have to have a FAFSA to get a loan.
Yes.
But there are some scholarship and grant places that also use the FAFSA, yes?
Think so, yeah. Lots of times if they're looking at kind of resource and income eligibility kinds of factors, a lot of grants and scholarships, they have a component determining what your need might be. So the FAFSA is going to assist them in that.
We are taking your calls right now. We've got Patrick from Madison. Patrick, welcome to the program.
Good morning. So my son is through college and has student loans, but he also is at a place where he can save for retirement. So he's putting 20% of his gross wages toward retirement, which I think is admirable. But my question is, does it make more sense to save for retirement or pay off the student loans when, you know, you have the opportunity to do either?
That's a great question. And some of it might have to do with looking at the competing rates of return, right? So if you think about if that student loan is a relatively low interest rate, and many of them are if you've gone through, you know, kind of the federal subsidized student loan model, I wouldn't feel too bad about that being kind of a regular planned payment over a certain period of time. Now, certainly your son is in a really nice position because they truly have the option where they could choose for a short period of time to be maybe a little bit less aggressive in their retirement planning package and use that money alternatively to pay down debt more quickly. I would say that, you know, again, as you noted, 20% is excellent
mm-hmm.
As a savings rate for retirement, and I think it's more people should be in that kind of area of the spectrum. But if you were to spend a time period maybe reducing that to 15% or something like that just to kind of shift some dollars in paying off that student loan debt, that would be a very reasonable strategy to adopt as well because he's really doing well hitting kind of some of those important to-dos at an early stage in life. Other things to look at would be opportunities. I don't know what kind of career path he's on. I don't know if he's on an income-based repayment plan or if he's looking at any case where his career would give him loan forgiveness after, say, oftentimes if you work a decade in something like working as a teacher or something, you might have forgiveness of the remainder of that debt.
You may have. We are taking your calls about your student loan plans. Sam from Madison, welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
So I actually dropped out of school my junior year, and it was probably the best financial decision I ever made. Looking into the requirements for the industry I was looking to go into, I'm an arborist now and a small business owner. I was told in high school that if I didn't go to college, I would be a failure. So it was definitely the right choice for me to get out of going to a four-year school and get into a trade, and I think that there needs to be a lot less emphasis on four-year schools over, you know, know, trades and other jobs.
Thank you for that, Sam. Yes, there are not, it's not always just a four-year school.
Yeah, I'm in complete agreement, despite the fact that I don't want students to stop coming to my classes. I would say yes. There's a lot of people, I think, that are discounting the role of trades and other industry jobs, and that this idea of you have to go to this four-year institution to achieve this level of education in order to be successful is very much a myth. And so there's many, many good careers out there for those that are willing to work.
We had another Patrick call. He's wondering whether he should put more money into 529s or save it elsewhere. He's got three kids. One goes to college in about 5 years, so that kid is 13, and he has twins who are 10. He's got more than $150,000 in college savings among the three. That's really good, actually. Yeah. What makes the most sense now?
Well, I think some of it's determining, again, I would do a little bit of projections, try to project out, okay, what is it roughly going to cost? If your intention is to fully fund their education, you might need a little bit more for three kids, right, mm-hmm. than $150,000. But again, you're in a really good spot if you've already got that amount saved. The nice thing about putting the money into a 529 plan, from my perspective, is that there's no limits on essentially your income or what could be put into there. And you do get a nice tax break in the state of Wisconsin. So if you're using something like EdVest, you're going to get $3,200 per beneficiary in state income tax breaks. Additionally, I kind of view it as if you somehow end up over-saving and putting too much money into those qualified plans, that money can be shifted to other relatives you might have, or it can be gifted in other ways or mm-hmm. used in other ways. And in the worst-case scenario, you can withdraw it for the penalty, very similar to kind of taking an early retirement withdrawal, that there's like a 10% penalty and you pay tax on it.
Interesting. If your kid wants to go to... I have a friend whose kid goes to school in Vancouver. He lives in Chicago. His son goes to school in Vancouver. Are the 529 plans set up to pay for that kind of thing?
In some cases, yes. So I'm not going to guarantee you that every institution in another country is covered, mm-hmm. but the idea that is a 529 plan is modeled to cover qualified education expenses, and that does not necessarily mean it must be restricted to the continental United States or like the United States in general.
We are taking one more call before we go. Lyman from Edgerton, welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning. Some people have spoken to this point already about the importance of the trades and the possibility of the trades being sort of an aspect that that people do instead of college. I'm proud to say that I graduated self-financed and debt-free from UW in 2002. The trades were sort of the key to my success in that regard. I worked full-time third shift in a factory and kind of paid as I went along. I'm happy to say I kept all 10 of my fingers. I'm wondering, what can we do to help students be more employable in the economy so that they may be able to sort of follow that model versus, buy now, pay later sort of mentality?
Okay, Lyman, thank you very much. You have about 30 seconds, Cliff.
Okay. I would say, one, that from what I see of the current student model, there are a lot of students out there that are working really hard to pay for their education, that are currently, they work day jobs and they manage their course schedule around it, whether they're on like Tuesday, Thursday classes, mm-hmm. they're going to work Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So I do think that's it's admirable, and it's a very real thing that a lot of students face in the present market.
We have been talking to Cliff Robb. He's an associate professor of consumer science and the faculty director of consumer finance and financial planning at UW-Madison. Thank you for being here, sir.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Carrie Kaufman. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.